Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Ayn Rand formulate her objectivist philosophies, and what makes the ideas she developed in the middle of the last century so appealing to many supporters today? Born Alisa Rosenbaum in 1905 in St. Petersburg, Russia, Rand's childhood was colored first by her mother's disdain and later by the Bolshevik Revolution's destruction of her father's business. She moved to Hollywood in her early 20s and found modest success as a screenwriter, but shot to fame after the publication of her 1943 novel, The Fountainhead. So how did Rand parlay that attention into support for her social and political philosophies, and to what extent do the full range of her ideas gel with those of her fans in the conservative movement today? Jennifer Burns is assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia. Her book is called Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. It's available now in trade paperback. Jennifer, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
In some ways, reading her life story, it's hardly surprising that Rand first expressed herself in movies and in novels because her early life was very dramatic.
Yeah, she had a life story that almost could have been a plot in one of her novels, complete with a struggle against an oppressive government, fame and fortune, love triangles. It's all, everything that's in her books is in her life and made her absolutely a fascinating character to study.
She was annoyed by the assumption that children should be carefree in nature when she herself was a child.
You know, it's very interesting. She seems to have been a very serious, very stern child, and to some degree, this played to her advantage because her mother was a very cosmopolitan, sophisticated woman who would trot her out before her friends and, you know, show off her recitation and how smart she was. But that sort of sense of seriousness defined Rand not only as a child but as an adult. She was very focused, very goal-directed, and sometimes had trouble enjoying the lighter side of things.
What impact did the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 have on Rand's immediate family?
It absolutely changed their life. She was the eldest daughter of a prosperous Jewish family. They had their own business. They had a thriving social life. They owned property. They were very comfortable. And all that changed almost overnight when the revolutionaries seized her father's shop in the name of the people and took away their livelihood. And moreover, the whole family was under a pall of suspicion because, you know, they were bourgeois. They were the class that the revolution was punishing. And so it was difficult for her father to find work. It was difficult for them to get educated, to find jobs. Everything changed. It tipped their world upside down.
She did manage to get a college education before she left Russia, in part because the revolution had opened some universities to women.
It's true. There were no longer quotas and restrictions on Jews and on women. But the really interesting thing is, I mean, this is like a sort of fun fact about Ayn Rand. Her undergraduate degree was from the University of Leningrad, right? So just think about that. She had a thoroughly communist education. Everything that was taught to her was taught in the service of the revolution. And so for her, knowledge became politicized. It was presented to her that way, philosophy, thought, literature, all that was political under the Bolsheviks. And when she got to America, she retained that sense. And so even as a fiction writer, she thought of her work as political. So she learned some lessons from the Bolsheviks that she hated, you know, and she carried with her whole life.
Yeah, this is such a fascinating study for exactly that reason. She, of course, for her entire life, professed to despise everything about communism. And yet you see a lot of parallels between Marxist ideology and her own thinking, just sort of turned upside down. Can you talk about some of the similarities that might not be obvious to people at first glance?
I think one would simply be her use of literature for ideological purposes. You know, there was a movement of socialist realism to create stories and characters who would serve the revolution and would embody the political ideals of socialism and communism. And Rand just turned that upside down. She would write pro-capitalist fiction with heroes and heroines that would embody sort of the capitalist virtues, independence, individualism, creativity, achievement. And she did that deliberately. She knew that communism and socialism had been successfully not just politically but culturally, and through culture they had spread their ideas and their values. And she said, my goal is to spread the ideas and values of capitalism through culture. So it was, in many ways, it's sort of deliberately inverted Marxism. Now, in her mature philosophy of objectivism, the other parallel we see is that objectivism claimed to be a comprehensive ideology that had an answer for everything, for the development of history, for psychology, for music. It was fully integrated and complete. And in much the same way, the sort of Marxist philosophy claimed to offer a guide for the whole person, the whole culture, the whole life. So again, she was trying to undo it by creating an alternative.
Can you remind us of the essential tenets of objectivism?
Sure. It's a complicated philosophy, but in keeping with its name, objectivism, it holds that there is an objective reality that man's reason can grasp, so it leaves no room for religion or for what she would call mystical belief. It argues that the most important virtue is rationality or self-interest, so selfishness is a virtue, and that capitalism is the only moral and practical social system.
And she had a great, almost contempt for the poor and uneducated, based, I suppose, on the notion that they were that way because of their own fault?
You know, she wouldn't have, you know, said she had contempt for the poor and the uneducated. She had contempt for people she thought weren't doing their fair share mm-hmm. and weren't contributing to society through productive work. So if you were poor or uneducated, as long as you were sort of trying your best and making a contribution, she tried to really stress that even though her heroes were engineers and, you know, architects and business people, that her philosophy could also apply to the bus driver or the cafeteria cook. It was not what you did so much as how you did it. But that being said, there can be in her work a sort of angry tone that many people interpret as, you know, contempt or anger towards those who aren't, you know, amazingly accomplished or amazingly creative and successful. So that is a tension in her work.
Talk about some of her influences, first in philosophy, the sort of people that she read that had written historically.
Yeah, I would say, well, later in her life, she claimed Aristotle to be her most important influence and her sort of the thinker she wanted to emulate. But I would draw our attention to another philosopher, the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, mm-hmm. who she discovered when she was an adolescent and just had an immediate connection to him. She devoured all his work. When she moved to America, the first books that she bought in English were English translations of his work. And when she published The Fountainhead, originally the manuscript, the book is divided into four parts, and each part had a quotation from Nietzsche at the beginning. And like at the very last minute, she decided to remove those from the book. And then she, you know, later in her career would talk about how she wasn't in sympathy with Nietzsche, and she thought he was fundamentally irrational, where she was a rationalist philosopher, but that attraction to his ideas really shaped her whole career.
What about people she knew? There were those she encountered as she was first starting her career in Hollywood and becoming a writer that had an influence on what she thought about.
Yeah, I think one very interesting influence is Cecil B. DeMille, who was her favorite director when she was in Russia. She idolized him, and she hadn't seen his religious films. They were not shown in Russia, so she wasn't aware of that side of his work, and she actually met him in person when she arrived in Hollywood. She managed to charm him with her stuttering Russian accent. He gave her a nickname. He called her Caviar, and he took her under his wing and showed her around, and I think that really influenced. She had sort of an apprenticeship under him. She did some screenwriting in the studio, and she learned how to make very dramatic and compelling plots and stories that would appeal to a lot of people, which, given her popularity today, we can see she's been very successful at doing that. So she kind of learned from the master in film and was able to transfer that over to fiction.
How was it decided that she ought to go to the United States in the first place? I mean, she clearly wouldn't have been happy remaining in St. Petersburg, but why the U.S.?
Well, she, her family had received a letter from some relatives who had left Russia prior to the revolution. And, the letter finally got through when Russian society had stabilized, and they owned a movie theater in Chicago. When they got the letter, Elisa, who was desperate. She was desperately unhappy. She said, please write to them and ask if I can come and if they will sponsor me. And they sponsored her under this ruse that she was going to learn about the American film industry, and then she would return and help Russia launch its film industry. And this was a major policy initiative in the Russian government. They wanted to prove that communist culture could be just as popular as American culture. And so, you know, this argument made sense to them. Now, Elisa and her whole family knew that she was not coming back. And this was just a pretext to get her out of the country, and then she was going to make her own fortune in America, a place she had always dreamed of going.
And she did have a wonderful time watching a lot of free movies when she was there in Chicago.
She did. She basically sat in the movie theater and tried to, it was silent films, but the words would be on the bottom of the screen. So that was one way she learned English. She did not know English very well when she arrived. And as anyone who's seen her, a video of her or recording, she had this incredibly strong Russian accent. And even when she was taught English, she found it difficult to speak in an English accent because it felt to her like she was imitating somebody else, and she wanted to have her own voice. So she had a very distinctive Russian accent, even as she learned how to write very fluently in English.
Let's talk about her name. To my ears, Elisa Rosenbaum is a prettier name than Ayn Rand. Where did Ayn Rand come from?
Yeah, it's a very interesting story, and I don't know that anyone has gotten to the bottom of it, because she said different things throughout her life. It was a name she created herself, and she did not let anybody know her name was Elisa Rosenbaum throughout most of her career in America. Her closest friends did not know her true name. Ayn was the name of, she took it from a Finnish playwright, she said, and then Rand, she said, was an abbreviation of her Russian name. Now, there's been many different theories floated about why she chose these. She said different things at different times. We know now that looking at letters between her and her family, she had experimented with different names before leaving Russia, and she almost called herself Lil, so she would have been Lil Rand, which has such a different ring to it and doesn't really seem to suit in the same way as Ayn. And so it's very fitting. She was a true individualist. She sort of created herself by giving herself her own name, and that for her really was the way in which she left Russia behind, left her old life behind, and said, you know, I'm a new person here in America. I'm creating myself, and I'm creating my life.
It was while she was in Hollywood that she met and married the actor Frank O'Connor. How would you characterize their relationship?
You know, it was a real yin and a yang, a real meeting of two very opposite people who managed to balance each other out. He was, by all accounts, just a lovely man, very kind, very gentle, very quiet, but he had a cutting wit. He could make her laugh. Mm-hmm. He could lighten her up, one of the few people to do that. But she always was the dominant figure in the relationship. She was the primary breadwinner. She made the decisions about where they would live, about how they would live. And at some points, this allowed Frank to pursue his own passions. He was a wonderful gardener and horticulturist. But towards the end of their life, she was really dominating him so much that he didn't have much say and in his own life, and he was unhappy. And there was she also had an affair with a younger man. That was a source of great pain to him. So they stayed together for 50 years, but it was not an easy union by any stretch.
Jennifer Burns is my guest. She's assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of the book Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. It's available now in paperback. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jennifer Burns. She's assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of the book Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Jennifer, when you talk about fun facts, mine is definitely this. She became a U.S. citizen in 1931, so of course she was able to vote. The first president she had occasion to vote for was FDR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very interesting fact because she would become such an opponent of Roosevelt later. She was not paying a huge amount of attention to politics, but she was caught by his opposition to prohibition. Mm-hmm. And she felt like prohibition was something that was none of the state's business. It was up to an individual to choose whether or not they used alcoholic beverages, and to have it be forbidden was wrong. So when she heard that he had a campaign promise to overturn prohibition, she thought, you know, this man is an individualist and I'm going to vote for him. Now, it wasn't many years before she had almost entirely reversed that opinion and come to regret her vote.
And by 1940, she was actively campaigning for his Republican opponent, Wendell Willkie.
That's right. You see it slow. And then mid-1930s, she's getting suspicious of him. And by 1940, she was actually in the middle of writing The Fountainhead. She stopped writing The Fountainhead, and she volunteered full-time for Wendell Willkie, his Republican opponent, because she thought that Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, it reminded her of Russia. To her, it was the slippery slope to socialism and communism, and if it didn't, wasn't stopped, everything that she treasured about America would be lost.
So she spent 7 years writing The Fountainhead, which is the story of Howard Roark, this architect, that includes sort of an early glimpse into the development of her political and her social philosophies. Tell us a little bit about the story and the things that are most important with regard to understanding where Rand was at the time.
So the story, essentially, there's a heroic protagonist, Howard Roark, who is cast out of architecture school and sort of mocked for his avant-garde designs, but over the course of the story, he never compromises his integrity or his artistic vision, and he eventually is vindicated. He finds success on his own terms and respect. And what Rand was really doing was using the sort of creative individual as a morality tale about the importance of individuals and creativity to any society. And it began as a more general philosophical work, and as she came to feel that the individual was being threatened by the expansion of government over the many years she worked on the book, it began to take on a more political cast towards the end. And it was thus received by many people as an argument against the New Deal and against the expansion of government. But what I think is critical to emphasize, it was not a negative argument, it was a positive argument. In other words, it celebrated what individuals could do rather than simply painting a negative picture of the state or arguing against the changes. So it seemed fresh and new and exciting when most of the arguments against Roosevelt seemed like they came from old rich guys who were past their prime. Mm-hmm. She was sort of a new voice on the scene, and that was very exciting to many people reading her for the first time.
She took at various times over her life and career really sort of bewildering stands in celebrating individual, I don't know if achievement is the right word. Talk about the story of William Hickman for a minute, if you would.
Yeah, this is one of the most difficult things to sort of wrestle with about Rand. Before she was writing The Fountainhead, when she was doing, writing in her notebooks and trying to design ideas, she had always, in the early part of her career, this attraction to the criminal as a metaphor for an individual. And one of her earlier plays, The Night of January 16th, was based on a criminal, Ivar Kruger, this Swiss match king, sort of the Bernie Madoff of his day, a tremendous fraud who defrauded a huge number of people. And she sort of took pieces of his personality and made them into this character in her play, because something about the criminal and the way the criminal stood in opposition to all society, she romanticized that. She saw that as a sort of powerful statement about individualism. And in a story that she planned but never wrote, you see her doing the same thing with this spectacular murder case in Los Angeles. The murderer was a young man named William Hickman who had tortured and raped women in the most awful ways. And so there was a great deal of tabloid discussion of this case. And somehow, as Rand looked at that, she sort of focused on the way in which this criminal to her was a sort of model of an individual who did whatever he wanted, not what society wanted him to do. Hmm. And as you read these notes, it's troubling. It's hard to sort of make sense of how she could look at someone accused of these terrible crimes and sort of extract a model or think of him as an individualist rather than a psychopath. And I think that by the time she got to the Fountainhead and Howard Roark, she'd almost completely moved away from that. But there is a way in which Howard Roark is antisocial, destructive. He blows up a building, and that's okay with Rand. That's kind of what she celebrated, that independence. So I would say, you know, she didn't have, it was an immature formulation at first to really celebrate the criminal, and it's a troubling part of her work. Now, she didn't intend those notes to be published, but we have them, and we know what they are, and so there's something that, you know, any serious student of Rand or fan of hers has to kind of wrestle with a little bit, I think.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Rusty calling from Nashville. Hi, Rusty.
Hi, thanks for a great conversation today.
Sure, thank you for calling.
Streaming you while traveling in Nashville, but I'm local to Dallas and enjoy your show.
Super.
With regard to some of these Superman-type hero characters, you just mentioned Howard Roark being one of them, John Galt, of course, being another terribly famous one of Rand's work. There is a very little-known link back to 19th century Russian literature that I thought some listeners, in particular the professor, might find interesting. The Russian writer V.L. Chernyshevsky wrote a fiction work entitled What is to be Done? That work of fiction, in turn, became the source of the title for Lenin's very famous pamphlet that led to the Russian Revolution. Chernyshevsky's main character, Rakhmatov, was that socialist model of a fully developed man working for the common good, which, as the professors noted, sort of finds its way through the looking glass into Rand's work. And I'd encourage people to check that out. V.L. Chernyshevsky's one of many great, great Russian writers, which in our bourgeois society are little known because they stayed on the wrong side of the fence as Narodnism and nihilism carried forward and led to the revolution. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call. Are you familiar with that work?
Yeah, I am, and the author makes a great point. I mean, one of the obvious ways we know Rand is a Russian novelist is the huge length of her books, right? You know, 700 and 1,300 pages or more. But yeah, you can think of her as coming out of a Russian literary tradition that there's political uses of literature. There's a celebration of the individual in different ways. She also loved Dostoevsky. That was a writer she really admired. So she does come out of this longer tradition. You can find connections, but it's also true that she was sort of tipping the tradition upside down or reacting against it in very specific, deliberate ways. So it there's a lot of inversions going on, and I think, you know, Rand, taker or leaver, she can be a very interesting route into a broader piece of intellectual history.
As far as you can tell, Jennifer, did the people who really responded to the Fountainhead and bought all these copies of it, did they all get the politics of it, or were some just sort of attracted to the sort of potboiler nature of the story?
That's a really good question. There were definitely some who got the politics, saw it as political, and wanted to promote it as political. And there were a number of business people, conservative writers, opponents of the New Deal. And Rand actually tried to start an organization working with some of these people, not just to promote her work, but to sort of promote her ideas. Then there's a large segment of people who just read it as sort of a parable about being true to yourself, independence, personal growth. And I read a lot of fan letters from people who said, you know, it sort of gave them the courage to be who they were or be strong. So you could take it in a number of different ways. I think her later work, it's more overtly political, so it's harder to overlook that piece of it. But as I said, the Fountainhead was sort of, you know, caught her transitioning from one set of interests to the next. And so it's a bit of a hybrid work in that way.
How much did she care what people thought of her?
I mean, that's a really interesting question because she celebrated the idea that you did creative work for its own sake and you should not at all care what people thought. But when Atlas Shrugged was greeted with terrible, terrible reviews, she was devastated because she was looking for respect and acknowledgement, and she was looking to be considered a thought leader, an intellectual of standing and stature. And she found it very difficult to accept that she wasn't immediately considered that way. So, you know, this is one of the things I sort of came to really understand over the course of the book. She, you know, is a human being like anyone else who was definitely more independent than most, more strong-willed than most, but she did have that longing for recognition and appreciation by other people, by people who she respected. And when she didn't get that from the, you know, mainstream media, she would go on to really found her own organization, the School of Objectivism, in which she could get the adulation that she craved and that she needed. And in the last third of her career, she surrounded herself with people who did not question her at all. And if they questioned her, she did not want them around. So she seemed to really need not just agreement, but adulation in a certain way in the latter part of her life.
Yeah, she wanted such loyalty that she even went so far as to dictate what her followers read, what they ate, how they decorated their apartments, and she wanted them, like her, to smoke.
It's true. She thought smoking, she had this sort of philosophy that, you know, to smoke was to show man's mastery over the world because you had sort of tamed fire in your cigarette. She had some ways sort of, she had the ability, as one person I talked to said, she was the evil Knievel of leaping to conclusions. In other words, she could take, you know, a cigarette and spin a whole philosophy around it. And so she had very specific ideas about what kind of music was good, what type of films were good. She had very strong aesthetic tastes. And it wasn't that she, you know, issued a bulletin telling everyone what they had to do, but people started imitating her because they felt the only way to get her to acknowledge them and respect them was to, you know, be just like her. So you have this tremendous irony of an individualist philosopher being surrounded by people who really weren't very individual at all, who were very conformist.
Did she sense that irony? Did she recognize it?
She did. Towards the end of her life, she did. She, as sort of objectivism reached its height, she felt frustrated sometimes that her students just blindly listened to her. She also became angry if they didn't listen to her, and she had a sense that she was sort of surrounded by people who weren't quite up to her level. What she didn't understand was that she had in some ways asked for that obedience, and then when people gave it to her, she was frustrated. But I did, you know, read some comments by a woman who'd been her secretary said, you know, she was surrounded by vipers. She was surrounded by people who were really using her in a way because they wanted to be near a famous person or they wanted to be in this certain literary set, and that she was in some ways very naive. She didn't understand that people might be currying favor with her and saying that they agreed with her ideas, even if they had doubts. Because she wouldn't have done that kind of thing. She was a very literal-minded person, and if she agreed, she would never pretend to agree with something in order to get ahead, because she just didn't think that way. So people could use her very easily because she would never notice. She would never understand that sort of type of human psychology.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to David in Dallas. Hi, David.
Hi. Very fascinating program, and thank you. Your guest has obviously done some wonderful work on Rand, but I wonder if she has any personal opinions or conclusions she's reached about Rand's core philosophy about the noble capitalist. I and some associates have discussed it recently, and what we've come up with is that the idea of the in a world with the Bernie Madoffs and international banker robber barons and collusion in health and secondary education, that the idea of the adamant and principled and noble capitalist really is an unfortunate fantasy, that there are no Hank Reardons, there are no Dagny Taggarts, there are unfortunately only Wesley Mouches. And I'd like to hear what your guest has to say, and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and it goes to sort of to what I was saying about Rand's personality, her literal-mindedness and her rationality, and also her choice to write fiction. You know, she was a moralist. You know, people should be rational. They should think towards the long term. And when she thought about businessmen, she argued that you would only profit if you thought about the long term, if you built a strong company, you know, if you had integrity, and that's what the characters in her book have. But she doesn't really wrestle with the other side of the coin, which is someone who doesn't have integrity, just wants to make a lot of money, and doesn't care how they do it, even if it's dishonest and even if they don't earn it. And so she didn't really grapple with that because she was presenting an ideal world where people would not be comfortable earning money through fraud and that somehow they would feel guilty if they earned money through fraud. And we know that many people don't feel guilty at all. Even when they're caught, they don't feel guilty at all. And so you know, she had a very subtle idea of selfishness, that her idea of selfishness was having a true self and being able to respect yourself. And she didn't really grapple with the more colloquial kind of selfishness, which is, I'm going to take what I need no matter how much it hurts you. I simply don't care. She would argue, you know, that's not what I meant, but it makes her philosophy inadequate to address a lot of the sort of, you know, crime that we see in the world. And a lot of that short-term, I just want my profit now, I really don't care what happens after that. Because those type of people in Rand's novels are only, they only work for the government. They're never capitalists. And that's not as the way the world works. It's not such a clear-cut division of good and bad into these different categories.
Am I correct that when you started working on this project, you were at Berkeley?
That's right.
Were people supportive of the study of Ayn Rand?
Yeah, they actually really were. I started writing this book as a dissertation, and you know, it was, you know, Bush was elected for a second term. Everybody knew that conservative thought and conservative ideas were very powerful in America, but they had not been given their due by historians who had preferred to look at other aspects of the past. And so, yeah, people are always shocked. Like, you did this at Berkeley? How could that happen? But, you know, Berkeley is really first and foremost a research university, and they were delighted that I was doing a new piece of research that hadn't been done, and that I could, you know, report back to them on what is Ayn Rand all about. You know, they were very curious. They were very grateful that I was on the case, so to speak.
Jennifer Burns is with us. She's assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of the book Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to be part of it, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jennifer Burns. She's assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of the book Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Jennifer, you've talked about Ayn Rand's relationship to her husband and the fact that she had the power in that relationship and made a lot of the decisions. Clearly, she was very influential in her own circle. And yet, you don't see in her books a lot of sort of proto-independent feminism. Can you talk about the way she appeared to view the role of women as at least as described in her literature?
Yeah, there's a lot of very interesting contradictions. On the one hand, there are some pretty strong female characters in her work. Her first novel, We the Living, has a female architect who's the protagonist, and Dagny Taggart in Atlas Shrugged is the female head of a railroad, and she sort of takes no prisoners and bosses all the men around. I think this comes through very clear in the recent Atlas Shrugged film. You really see that strong central female character. Yet at the same time, she had this idea that women were supposed to worship men. They were supposed to look up to men. And she wrote this essay in the late 60s that really confounded all of her fans, that said a woman should not ever want to be president, because if a woman were president, she would not be able to look up to any man. And the type of woman that would want to be president and not able to look up to any kind of man would be a psychologically flawed woman and not fit to be a leader. And so people just did not know what to make of this essay, and it's very hard to understand. Rand was in her own life very independent, very strong, the breadwinner. She came out as adamantly pro-choice. It was a woman's body. It was a woman's decision and her right. Yet she had this very strange sort of regressive idea about man worship. And I really think the only way to understand it is just to look at her own life. And, you know, she was a very strong woman raised in a culture that expected her to be feminine and weak and retiring. And she, you know, was a writer in a time when women were not welcome in intellectual circles. Women, you know, were not given a public voice, and she had to fight very hard to be heard. And it was almost as if to compensate for that, she had this theory about how women should be feminine, even though she didn't follow that in her own life. And so there is a sort of strange proto-feminism in some of her fiction, but there's also this weird regressive element to it. And, you know, feminists in the 1970s did not know what to make of her. And Susan Brown Miller said she was a traitor to her sex. And that's kind of been the verdict ever since.
I don't know that there is any philosopher whose followers don't, at least to some degree, sort of cherry pick the things that they really embrace and want to believe in and the things that they will cast aside. But it is strange that this woman who was, as you said, a pro-choice atheist has found so much support with the American Tea Party movement, which is not entirely, but somewhat composed of people on the religious right.
Yeah, that is this sort of fascinating irony I've been watching unfold. In the 1950s, religious conservatives considered Rand a threat because she shared their economic ideas, but she did not share their social or cultural or religious ideas, and they saw her as a challenge. She might sort of change things, or she might run away with their free market ideas and end up tying them to this terrible atheism. You know, I think at this point in time, you know, they have been brought together on the ground of the conservative movement, that is Christian belief and free market belief. Mm-hmm. And it seems that the Tea Party, what they draw from her is this division of people into the productive and those who are looters or moochers. And this kind of division, you know, dividing the world into two types of people, one good and one bad, runs through Atlas Shrugged. It's very, very prominent. And so that seems to be a way that a lot of the Tea Party sees the world. In other words, there are some Americans who are productive and, you know, creating value and paying taxes, and there are other Americans who are simply taking government money and not contributing anything to society. And, you know, she embodies that worldview and gives it form and structure and fiction so powerfully that most people don't pause to recognize how much of that worldview sort of grows out of her atheism and grows out of her belief that you're really only valuable according to what you accomplish in the world. You're not valuable unto yourself. You are only valuable as to what you achieve. And so they simply take this binary view, and then it's combined with, you know, whatever personal religious beliefs people have. And it's a strange mixture for sure. But I would say, they say politics makes strange bedfellows. And, you know, consistency is not the most important virtue in politics. And so this, you know, very inconsistent mixture has proved very potent at this historical moment and also in the past.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Keith on the line in Dallas. Hello, Keith.
Hi. I've always heard that during her lifetime, after The Fountainhead was made into a movie and Ayn Rand didn't like it, that she always said Atlas Shrugged would never be made into a movie while she was still alive, which, of course, it was not. But I was just curious what Professor Burns thought of Atlas Shrugged Part 1, and will there be a Part 2 or 3?
Rand had a bad experience with The Fountainhead. You're absolutely right. She considered making Atlas Shrugged into a TV miniseries. That was something she was working on, and then the project didn't come to fruition. I don't know whether there'll be a 2 or a 3. I understand number 1 was not hugely profitable, but I enjoyed it as someone who's read a lot of Rand and seeing someone's interpretation of those characters and those stories. I mean, that I got a kick out of that. I think the film's production values were obviously not particularly high, and I think that they chose to emphasize some of the more politically relevant and politically hot parts of the novel over others. But what really struck me about that movie was how clearly this strong female character came through, and how almost contemporary that felt, even though this was a novel that was written in 1957. So that really underscored for me how unusual Rand's decision to kind of cast a female in the lead was, and it seemed to, you know, kind of reverberate with our current moment as well.
I want to talk a little bit about something you alluded to earlier, which is the relationship between Rand and Nathaniel Brandon, who started as a loyal follower and was something like 12 years younger than she was, and then became her lover with the full knowledge of both her husband and Brandon's first wife?
That's right. He was actually 25 years younger than her.
25 years.
He was a college student when they met. He was an avid believer in her philosophy. They had this intense intellectual and emotional connection, and over time, they grew closer and closer and closer, and Rand seduced him. And, you know, after they had professed their love for each other, she said, well, now we need to talk to our spouses. We must be rational about this. Hmm. And so she called them all to a meeting, and she said, we've fallen in love. You understand why this would happen. You know that it makes sense, and we would like permission to spend time with each other alone. And, you know, she said that we will just be, this will not be a romantic affair. And then they said yes. And then she called them a little bit later and said, well, now it's going to be a romantic affair. And they said yes. And so it began. And she had such a hypnotic spell on all three of them that it made sense in some strange way. And they agreed to it, and so it became a long-running affair that was kept very secret from everybody, even as Nathaniel was acknowledged as her number one student and her intellectual heir. You know, nobody knew that they had a romantic relationship, and then it ended very badly when he took up with someone else. And again, no confession was made, but he was cast out of the Objectivist circle in a great public scandal. So it wasn't until after Rand's death that the full story emerged.
And Brandon later went on not only to denounce a lot of Rand's ideas, but to, am I right, he was part of the self-esteem movement that rose up in the 1970s?
Yes, yes. And that's this other really interesting thread of where Rand's influence can be found. You know, he broke with her, but he remained very influenced by her ideas. And so this self-esteem movement, it owes a lot to Rand. On the other hand, Brandon had developed a form of objectivist psychotherapy while working with Rand, and he described his later work as an effort to undo the damage he had done while he was an objectivist psychologist, because he ultimately felt he had his work, which emphasized judgment and emphasized reason over emotions, he felt that had been very psychologically damaging for him. So, you know, he framed his later work as an attempt to heal the people that Rand's philosophy had damaged.
Let's go next on the phones to Brad in Dallas. Hey, Brad.
Hello.
Hi.
I guess I have a question for the professor about what you've seen in kind of pop culture, how it's kind of looked at Ayn Rand lately, like in an episode of The Simpsons, and also two very popular video games called Bioshock and Bioshock 2. Has she heard of those?
Yes, I have. Rand moves in popular culture very easily, which is, I think, another reason for her influence, because you can make a reference to her very quickly without having to sort of bog down in economic theory or, you know, very abstruse ideas. The Bioshock story is interesting because the creator of that video game said he intended it as a criticism of ideology and a criticism of systems where, you know, there's only one answer and you must sort of conform to that. So he intended it, and he took Rand and objectivism as kind of a symbol of that all-encompassing ideology, which he wanted to critique. But I think really the video game has simply spread recognition of her ideas rather than serving as a critique of them. That's pretty interesting. And people have talked about the sales of Atlas Shrugged going up with each bailout during the financial crisis, but I saw someone else tried to graph them according to release dates of Bioshock and saying that when this Bioshock comes out, everyone goes and buys Atlas Shrugged because they're trying to figure out what the game's all about.
Do you think we have reached the pinnacle of sort of this new obsession with Ayn Rand that we've seen over the past decade or so?
We have reached a high point. It may go higher still. I think that Rand has given a lot of political voices on the right a very coherent and clear ideology that they have found easy to translate into, you know, public policy, and to say this is kind of the philosophy behind, you know, why we oppose increasing the debt limit, or why we oppose health care, or why we oppose bailout spending. And, you know, right now that voice is very dominant because there isn't a strong counter argument that's as clear cut as sort of pithy. And so if that counter argument can be articulated, it may push back against the set of Randian arguments we're seeing. But I would not want to go on the record saying we've reached a peak, because she keeps peaking more and more, and the more people talk about her, the more people read her. And, you know, as they read her, some people reject her and some people embrace certain parts of her. So I think we probably have some time to go in terms of the growth of her influence, or at least growth of knowledge about her.
Can we fully understand her philosophies, Jennifer, if we rely on the novels alone?
I think you can. I think you can, but I think it's important to understand her life and how her background played into the formation of her philosophy. Mm-hmm. And it's also important to think about how that philosophy operates, not just in the novel, which is a world that was created for it, but how did that philosophy play out in the real world? And I think that's where learning about the history of the Objectivist movement is really important, because there was an organized community that tried to live by Rand's philosophy. And many of those people later in life said that was a great mistake, and it was a very difficult and even traumatic time in their life when they tried to live completely according to objectivism. In some ways, living according to objectivism undermined their own sense of individuality, which is this terrible, terrible irony. But there's a lot of people who have documented that. I talk about it at length in the book. So I think, you know, in her novels, you will get all the messages that Rand was meaning to communicate, but I think an important part of the story is what happens when you take those ideas out of fiction into the real world.
Any sense of what she might think about her most ardent supporters in 2011?
You know, she would be, I think, very upset with the continued presence of religious conservatives embracing her ideas. In fact, one of the last things she published was a denunciation of Ronald Reagan. And she said Reagan was so dangerous because he mixed religion and politics. And, you know, she was a really firm believer in separation of church and state. And, you know, we might understand this as part of her Jewish background, that when religion and politics mingle, religious and ethnic minorities often are scapegoated and are punished. And so she strongly felt that political arguments and policy decisions should be guided by science and by rationality, by principle, not by religion. So I think a lot of the Tea Party would very much upset her.
Jennifer Burns is assistant professor of history at the University of Virginia and author of Goddess of the Market, Ayn Rand and the American Right. It's available now in trade paperback. Jennifer, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.